Okay, everybody, welcome to episode 11 of Porkins Policy Radio. As always, I'm your host, Pierce Redmond, and you can always find everything related to this podcast, related to my work, at porkinspolicyreview.wordpress.com. And today we have an extremely special guest, all the way from the sunny climes of Western Japan. We have James Corbett. James is the editor of CorbettReport.com, which is probably the most invaluable news site out there on the internet. He's got hours and hours of video, audio, all sorts of things like that, free for download. He is a contributor to BoilingFrogsPost.com. He produces videos for Global Research, and he is also the editor of the International Forecaster newsletter. And on a personal note, James is the reason that I got into this whole truth movement and alternative media. So, James, thanks so much for joining us on the show today.
Well, it is a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So I've invited James on to talk about the term blowback, which is a term that is used very often in the media, in popular culture, and it has sort of taken on a life of its own. And it is something that has become synonymous with the war on terror. And in my opinion, it is a concept that is actually sort of misused very often. So I've invited James on to talk about this. So James, perhaps first you could just give the listeners the sort of official definition of blowback.
Well, blowback is the theory that there are unintended consequences to covert operations or to actions of any sort, generally speaking, in the foreign policy arena. And so the classic ideas of this come from critiques of basically U.S. imperial aggression around the world. And in fact, there's been entire books written about this entitled Blowback. Chalmers Johnson wrote a book called that, The Costs and Consequences of American Empire, which I'm going to confess I haven't read. But I think we all understand to one extent or another the idea. And some of the classic examples of this, of course, probably one of the most famous is the blowback of what happened in Afghanistan after the U.S. Went in and supported the forces fighting against the Soviet Union. And lo and behold, wouldn't you know it, a couple of decades later, those same peoples who were fighting against the Soviet Union ended up turning against the Americans, and they were called Al-Qaeda. And that came back to bite America in the bottom. And that's basically the idea of blowback, and it's become quite popularized, especially in the age of the war on terror, because it does provide a convenient narrative, generally for the left, to explain and process the types of things that are happening, especially in, for example, the war on terror, that doesn't fundamentally challenge the establishment. It doesn't fundamentally challenge the status quo. Basically, what it says is that this is a type of incompetence theory, that that the government is just too stupid to realize that their actions are going to have consequences that might be detrimental in the future. And they wouldn't you know it, they just keep doing these things over and over and over again that ultimately ends up creating America's own enemies. So the official left position can then become, well, why don't we just stop doing these foreign policy actions? And I guess that would be, in fact, a good idea. But of course, this is not going to happen. And this is just another way of supporting sort of the status quo and the establishment with a narrative that comes prepackaged with a little bow for the people who want to basically continue doing what they're doing. And that's the long and the short of it. And I think there's a lot of interesting examples that we can take a look at in that regard.
Yes, absolutely. And I guess just to preface this, there are instances where blowback is real and is a real occurrence. There was the case a few years ago of Humam al-Balawi, who is a CIA double agent who ended up walking into a CIA complex in Khost and blowing himself up and killing, I think, several CIA operatives as well as some Blackwater mercenaries. And I guess, you know, in to a degree, that is sort of blowback. You know, if you play with fire, you're going to get burned at some point. And obviously, if you are allying yourself with various, terrorists, quote unquote, then at some point, this could come back to bite you in the butt. But as you say, that is a very simplistic view of the term blowback. And especially on the left, it is used continually over and over again to basically just explain, well, if we didn't do this, then, you know, this wouldn't happen. But as I say, this is a very simplistic view, and it doesn't really contextualize the complexities of the war on terror. So perhaps we could get into some of the major issues with the concept of blowback and how it has evolved into a component of the war on terror paradigm. And particularly, maybe we could start with the notion that this is incompetence and how this is popularized by, you know, the elite, essentially, in order to explain all of this away, and how that sort of fails to really explain that there is so much complicity between the government and these terrorists.
Well, that's really the key point. The blowback theory only works in a contextless environment where only certain pieces of information are given to the public. So the officially approved myth of the war on terror, of course, is that the U.S. government has had no collusion, no contact, no interaction with, for example, the Al-Qaeda boogeyman in the intervening time between the 1980s and 9/11, for example. And in fact, even then, of course, they have the myth that the American funds in the Afghan war only ever went to the Afghan fighters.
Yes.
Or to the Pakistani ISI. It never went directly to the so-called Arab Afghans, which included Osama bin Laden and his cohorts. So they have a number of layers of plausible deniability baked into that cake. But basically, it does rely on this idea that there was no contact whatsoever, that they weren't colluding in any form. That there was no contact. But for example, people who have been listening to the Gladio B interview series that I did with Sibel Edmonds earlier this year will know that, in fact, there was high-level contact between high-level American State Department officials and the number two person in al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri, Osama bin Laden's right-hand man, throughout the 1990s, right up until 9/11, colluding on various operations, including what was happening there in Bosnia and what was happening in the Caucasus generally, which should indicate that this blowback theory is basically twaddle, at least in this particular instance, because obviously if they are collaborating with these people, then the idea that this is simply incompetence has to at least be called into question. And I suppose you could still argue, well, yes, they were just playing with the fire, and they haven't really admitted that yet. But even if that's true behind the case, then still it just came back to bite them. But then I guess we can look at all of the other reasons why that would be nonsense. Especially, of course, the fact that American intelligence knew exactly where Osama bin Laden was the night of 9/11 because he was staying at a military hospital in Rawalpindi, under the watchful gaze of the Pakistani ISI, which is an adjunct of the CIA. So again, there's a number of different ways that we could explore and interrogate that. But you're exactly right that incompetence is the basic premise here that a lot of people intuitively understand at a human level. We understand how it's how large organizations just make silly moves and mistakes, and how it's difficult to keep track of a lot of things. So we can understand, oh, well, it must have been incompetence. They mustn't have been able to really keep track of what was going on. So it provides a convenient narrative that people can relate to that explains things in a way that, again, doesn't fundamentally question the system. The only question with blowback is, well, okay, so what are we going to do about future foreign policy actions to make sure it doesn't happen again? But if the entire point was to generate those reactions, then, well, you've missed the whole point of how to critique this and how to go about dismantling it. And I think another aspect of this that we should bring in here is that, yes, I think that sometimes blowback is just a convenient myth that they throw over things. But as you say, there are real instances of blowback. There are times in which actions do provoke unintended consequences, or at least provoke consequences that are detrimental to U.S. interests or what have you. And we should also look at the fact that sometimes that is not unintended, that is intended. Mm. In fact, if you go back to the creation of P2OG in 2002, that's the Proactive Preemptive Operations Group in the Pentagon under Rumsfeld's Pentagon. It was the creation of a group that was specifically aiming to provoke terrorism by creating insufferable conditions for various people. In fact, looking at their documents themselves, it said, quote, among other things, this body would launch secret operations aimed at stimulating reactions among terrorists and states possessing weapons of mass destruction. That is, for instance, prodding terrorist cells into action and exposing themselves to quick response attacks by U.S. forces. So again, sometimes blowback is completely engineered and completely part of what the U.S. forces or whoever actually want to achieve. So there's a lot of different ways to deconstruct this, but I think it's quite alarming how easily and quickly this is taken up by academics and by those on the left who don't want to really fundamentally question the official narratives of any of these events. But it just provides a framework for us to understand those events.
Oh, absolutely. And the whole idea that they wouldn't want these unintended consequences, for me, on face value, is just silly, because ultimately that just feeds into this whole war on terror narrative, you know? So, you know, even the unintended consequences, well, that's great. Well, then we can just send in NATO and we can send in more, you know, CIA murderers and so forth, and it ultimately it's just feeding into this giant beast. So to think that the unintended consequences aren't a great thing for the government, for the state, is just for me is very silly. But and perhaps we can also touch upon the, how I see it, just the inherent racism associated with blowback. Seemingly, it's only Muslims that are affected by this, which again feeds into this whole narrative of a clash of civilizations between the West and the Muslim world. It portrays them as very violent and vengeful. But, you know, we don't see Guatemalans coming and flying planes into buildings here, despite the fact that we helped to foment a civil war there where hundreds of thousands of people were killed. So I find it very fascinating that sort of gets missed, especially on the left, this racism.
Well, I think you're right to point that out, and especially in the modern war on terror context. But of course, blowback has been used in other contexts before involving non-Muslims. I mean, for example, back in the 1980s, the American funding of the right-wing Contras back in Nicaragua against the Sandinistas was, of course, the creation of this, the right-wing Contra, you know, death forces and all of this. So that's been pointed out as an example of blowback. But the point is well taken that certainly this does generally involve, at this point in time, at any rate, the demonization of Muslim communities. And that... certainly one of the consequences of a blowback theory in the war on terror taken to its logical conclusion would be that we can't really support any of these Muslim groups or Muslim countries in any overt way, because we never know how it's going to come back and get us. And that might be one of the sort of overarching conclusions that people might take away from this theory.
And sort of piggybacking on that, we hear a lot in the media about the blowback from drone strikes. And I think, again, this also has just a weird connotation with that, because it fails to point out the mass protests in Pakistan against the drone policy there. And these are, by and large, peaceful protests. But of course, we're never presented with that image. Instead, it's just the image of, oh, well, you know, if we bomb Pakistan, then they're, you know, everyone who lost a family member, they're going to just turn into terrorists. And again, it sort of, you know, paints this picture that for whatever reason, Muslims are much easier to be swayed into wanting to go and you know, blow up an American building or what have you.
Right. Yes. It kind of, there is that element of dehumanization or depersonalization. At any rate, it becomes more of a process rather than a story about actual human beings. And interestingly enough, I was in fact just reading something in the New York Times just a couple of weeks ago about, I believe it was a Yemeni who had just lost one of his relatives in a drone strike, who came to Washington to actually talk to some of the senators and others who were involved in the decision to launch that drone strike. So it was kind of an interesting story from especially an outlet like the New York Times, but I guess an attempt to humanize that that experience, which again is extremely important, and it is important to keep it in that context of the fact that this is not just some kind of random thing that happens at in a robotic fashion. This is something that obviously builds up over time, especially the opposition to things like the drone strikes, which, as anyone who's been following the entire debate there in Pakistan and what's happening there knows, that this isn't simmering an ongoing issue that's really generating a lot of anger, to the point where I don't think anyone could say at this point that, oh well, the Americans just didn't know that these drone strikes would make the Pakistanis angry, and you know, or something along those lines. I mean, it's beyond that point, quite obviously right now. So I think you're right. I think it's to a certain extent this idea, this narrative, does kind of dehumanize the experience and makes it into a bit of an equation, whereby this one aggression creates a terrorist or something along those lines. Mm.
In your conversation with Sibel Edmonds on Gladio B, you know, she just brought up the point, how many times can they make the same mistake? Which seems, you know, that's also a very simple observation, but it does just strike you. I mean, how many times can we fund Al-Qaeda, be it right now in Syria, and then, you know, turn around and say, oh my God, look, Al-Qaeda is running amok in Syria. So you know, I that's why I, for me at least, I don't really understand how so many people are able to just accept this theory of blowback, you know, so easily, when you just, I mean, just simply look at history. I mean, you know, we fund these groups and then they supposedly turn on us, but we never really seem to learn. And again, as you said, it paints this picture of the security state as just a bunch of buffoons making silly mistakes over and over and over again. And I'm not really sure how and why that is so widely accepted amongst the general public.
Well, if we psychologize it, I think it does provide a convenient way for people to look at it, to be able to look down their nose at the people who are making these decisions, because, I'm smarter than these people. I can see what's going to happen. So it does kind of appeal to a certain sense of intellectual vanity, which obviously explains perhaps its popularity among the academic class and people of that ilk, because again, it shows that, oh, well, you know, these incompetent boobs who are just, you know, gung-ho for the American empire, they don't understand what's going to happen because of their actions. But of course, again, that is falsified by exactly, as you say, as Sibel points out, the fact that this happens over and over and over and over and over. I mean, we could think of dozens and dozens and dozens of examples from the past few decades alone, and which would give the lie to the idea that this is not a foreseen or a well understood consequence. I mean, we could look even, for example, at Libya, and oh well, we didn't know that bombing the place to smithereens and deposing the leader and basically letting chaos reign would lead to chaos. We had no idea. So again, we've seen so many examples of this that it is ridiculous, but it does appeal to people's intellectual vanity. It makes them seem like they're smarter because they have it figured out, whereas these planners and the people who are committing these actions just don't seem to get it. I think that at least partially explains why it appeals to the public so much.
And even taking that case of Libya again, we can look to the Tuareg rebellion, which is still going on in Mali, and that was almost instantly cited in the mainstream media by the talking heads as, oh, this is blowback. You see, we got rid of Gaddafi, and now all of these Tuaregs are running into Mali with all of these arms. And while that is true, that you know, that did happen, I think, again, it really fails to put into context this notion of destabilization, that this is what the American government does right now amongst all of these countries. And in Mali, you know, we've got the complete disintegration of really any sort of working formal government there. And the Tuareg rebellion, as it was going on after the Libya debacle, then we see the government being overthrown by a Colonel Sanogo, who was trained in the United States. And now, of course, we've got France going in there and exploiting all of these natural resources, particularly gold and uranium. So maybe, James, you could touch on this a little bit, this idea of destabilization, because, it, you know, again, when these various destabilizations happen, very often the blame is put on blowback, some sort of unintended consequence. And I think that fails to point out the fact that this is what they want. They want to destabilize all of these countries. And hence, that's why they end up time and time again allying themselves with very nefarious characters.
That's right. And it does provide that convenient excuse to continue, basically, the destabilization, because, well, what are you going to do? You have to clean up the blowback now. And so it provides that kind of excuse for failing forward, as it were. So I think you're right. And that's a good example. Speaking of Libya and Mali, we could think of other examples. I mean, even if you want to look at, for example, the invasion of Iraq, and then suddenly you had these sectarian tensions that started to escalate somehow or other in the post-invasion Iraq. And again, I think this is an example of what would be cited as blowback. Oh, well, suddenly now we've got the creation of these groups that are incensed and are fighting American forces. Whereas, of course, if we look at the long-term strategic plans that have been in place since the 1980s, it was precisely to break Iraq into three warring factions, divided along the kind of religious and ethnic lines, with the Kurds and the Sunnis and Shias fighting it out amongst each other to precisely to destabilize that country and to make it something that was, if not ungovernable, at least not a really coherent functioning whole state that would provide any sort of regional power or influence. So again, it does provide that convenient cover for those types of operations where the intended outcome itself is the type of chaos, is the type of destabilization, which, again, can look like simple blowback, but it's not blowback if it's planned to be that way and if it's specifically engineered into that type of situation. Or if not, I mean, at the very least, we need a different term or a different concept for understanding that particular type of blowback, because I think that's probably far and away the most common type that exists, to the extent that the blowback itself isn't fake after all. I mean, for example, in the Iraqi context, the blowing up of the Golden Mosque, was it in 2004, 2005? Mm. There's been a lot of intel that has indicated that had help from American forces, specifically as the type of flashpoint event that could further destabilize Iraq and cause more of these tensions. So again, I think we have to look at and question some of the blowback actions themselves, quote unquote, as potential staged events in order to basically destabilize the situation even further.
Mm. And I think that that's really the crux of understanding the war on terror as it exists today. And I think that there, you know, there is a lot of information out there for people to find if they want to, that, you know, goes towards explaining this sort of hoax that's been perpetrated against us, that, you know, the war on terror does not really exist. It is not this amorphous group known as Al-Qaeda or Islamic terrorism, and then just the gung-ho USA, USA crowd. This is something that's been in the making for many, many years. You've referenced many times before the, I believe it's the PNAC paper that basically just laid out, you know, everything that happened under Bush. So these things are planned. These are orchestrated behind the scenes. And I think until people really wake up to that realization, then you will be stuck in this very childlike state where, yeah, it's just blowback, it's just a mistake, sorry, you know, we won't do it again, even though they ultimately continue to do it over and over and over again. One other thing is this popularization of the term by the very people that are guilty of being involved in this. And particularly, I found one person who, I must confess, I did read and follow somewhat for a while, and that's this character known as Michael Scheuer, and he was a former I think the head of the Bin Laden unit at the CIA, and he has used this term blowback over and over and over again. And I find it very suspicious that the people popularizing this phrase are the very people that are involved at the top with all of this. And for Michael Scheuer to go on and say, "Oh, I had no idea, you know, we never gave the Arab Afghans any money. That was the ISI," is also quite suspicious.
Exactly right. And this is something that has been woven into the fabric of the entire war on terror myth and is propagated, I think, by people who fully well know what they're doing in the seeding of this narrative. And yes, we can look, for example, at a Michael Scheuer, as you say, former head of Alex Station, the CIA Bin Laden unit, and someone who has been a vocal critic of the Bush administration, of less so the Obama administration. He's been much less visible in the last few years, but has been a vocal critic of the waging of the war on terror, but in ways that again ultimately play into the system itself. In fact, back in 2009, there was some brouhaha over some comments that he made where he was on a Fox program with Glenn Beck, saying, quote, only Osama can execute an attack that will force Americans to demand that their government protect them effectively, consistently, and with as much violence as necessary. So someone who is still very much, I think, working within that system and for the system that helped to spawn and create this entire narrative itself is one of the people who is out there popularizing the term. And it is one that can be used to rally, against certain policies, and it can be a politically perhaps effective way of counteracting certain of the more egregious aspects of something like the war on terror. But at the end of the day, again, if people in positions of power are afforded the convenient escape switch that the blowback theory provides them, namely, well, you were just too incompetent to understand what was going to happen, then they will use that. And in fact, they will seed that narrative into the very fabric of what they're doing, and they'll probably front run it by making outrageous statements like Cheney, "Oh, we're going to be greeted with flowers, you know, as liberators in Iraq." Oops, oh, we didn't know people would be angry. And people fall for it. People, again, time and time and time and time again, believe that they're being honest. They're talking at face value when they say these types of things. And another example that I would point to in recent years has been Adam Curtis at the BBC, a documentarian who makes extremely interesting, compelling documentaries, often with very important information. I don't dismiss the information that he puts into those documentaries or the way that he does it. He's a very, very talented documentary filmmaker. But if you watch something like... the name is going to escape me.
The Power of Nightmares?
Yes, thank you. The Power of Nightmares. Again, it is absolutely the driving narrative of The Power of Nightmares that this is all just blowback, and it's it's really a fight between these Muslim terrorists who believe that they're going to live with 72 virgins in the sky versus the neocons who are all devout Christians who really want to spread democracy and freedom to the Middle East. And there's just absolutely nothing whatsoever happening under the surface in Adam Curtis's documentaries. All of it is taken at face value, exactly as we would expect in a blowback theory, where basically at the end of the day, it's officials who genuinely believe in what they're doing and they genuinely want to spread American imperialism or whatever it is. But oops, wouldn't you know it, we have these unintended consequences to deal with. So it's certainly a term that's been popularized in recent years. And I think, you know, often by people like Scheuer, who are very much, I mean, once CIA, always CIA, I imagine. So I certainly take things that he says with a giant grain of salt, even when he does provide some compelling critiques of the system. At the end of the day, his analysis just serves to bolster that system. Mm.
And of course, Chalmers Johnson was also a CIA official. So again, very interesting that this former CIA official, I don't know if he was official, but he did work with them for many years. And then he comes out with this series of three books all on blowback. So again, little concerning there, I guess, if you're really going to take him at face value on this. And
just to be clear, he was a consultant for the CIA from 1967 to 73, whatever that means.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, of course. And when he, who knows when he really stopped consulting for them. Well, I guess just to kind of break this down slightly more, but just this whole, where are we right now with the war on terror? Partly with blowback, but just in a larger context, perhaps. Because we're at this stage right now where, again, terms like blowback are used constantly. People still seem to kind of fail to see the complexity of what's going on around them. Civil liberties disappearing, things of that nature. And where do you see, in your opinion, the war on terror going from this point on?
That's a big question. I'm not sure. I'm not really sure how to answer that properly. Obviously, this is always placed in that political context of the left-right political charade, which my listeners will know I don't put a lot of stock in. But at any rate, it does provide slightly different narratives. And so I think that the predominant narrative under Republican administrations tends to be this blowback narrative, that they go too far. Their imperial hubris drives them too far, and then the blowback is the unintended consequences of that. Whereas under Democratic administrations, it's often more focused on domestic issues, where in foreign policy issues they tend to be more collaborative with the United mm-hmm. Nations and things like this. So less of the room for those types of blowback narratives to occur. And I guess we can broadly say that this has been a pattern under Obama, but of course we've already talked about Libya and Syria, so I suppose that's a bit out of the window. But at any rate, we've seen in the last couple of years the indications, and in fact even in one speech, the outright statement that the war on terror, if not being over, at least has to end at some point, which is something that was unthinkable under the previous Bush administration, obviously. So I think that this is a narrative that can be will always be kept on board for future actions, but maybe its usefulness in the particular Al-Qaeda narrative has run its course, and we're starting to see that that being pushed aside. But again, as an overall narrative to explain what's happening, it's still very, very, very useful for the powers that shouldn't be. And as we say, for example, when it comes to the drone strikes, this is something that is very much setting the stage for whatever comes next. And whether that might be something that allows, for example, greater U.S. presence in Yemen to deal with the unintended consequences of their drone strikes or what have you. At any rate, we can see that kind of preparatory framework being prepared right now. So I mean, it's something that other than confronting it head on, I'm not sure how to really confront it, because this is the idea that has really percolated into the collective conscience of Americans now, to the point where I think they intuitively understand this idea, and it doesn't take a lot of setting up to explain. Whereas something like Gladio B requires a lot of history lesson and contextualization for a public that just has no way of taking that information and putting it into a narrative framework, because not a lot of people have articulated it. So I mean, I think you can say that certain political theories really do have an advantage simply by being familiar to the public, and blowback certainly enjoys that advantage at this point in time.
Yes, and if anyone is really interested in understanding the war on terror in a deeper sense, the series that you did with Sibel Edmonds on Gladio B is just absolutely fantastic. It's very in-depth. It's long. They're just really, really insightful analysis by both of you. And it really, it just puts to shame this whole control grid that has been put up called the War on Terror. And it shows just the complete collusion between the West and terrorism and NATO. It touches on everything from drug trafficking to nuclear arms smuggling and you know, everything of that nature. And it really just, as I said, it just puts to shame this whole notion, and especially this blowback, because as you mentioned before, there was just too much collusion. There was no way that they could just really think, oh, well, nothing really will happen. It won't really be that bad. And yeah, you know, maybe, you know, one or two people, but it's okay. Don't worry about it. And we'll just keep on doing this no matter what. Well, James, I guess we might be getting to the end of this conversation right here. But I've had an excellent time talking with you, and I would absolutely love to have you back on the show again to talk about a whole myriad of issues, the economy, things of that nature. But before we go, could you tell the listeners where they can go to view more of your work, learn about you, and maybe a little bit about yourself as well?
All right. Well, I'm a Canadian living in Japan. I've been out in Japan since 2004. I was originally here just teaching English, and eventually I started to encounter some of the information that started to go against the grain of everything I thought I had known about the way the world worked. And as a result of encountering that information and not seeing it reflected in the mainstream media, even though I could verify it for myself through online sources, I eventually reached a breaking point and decided, well, I had better throw myself into that mix. So I just created CorbettReport.com more or less on a whim. It was very spontaneous, one of the few spontaneous actions I've ever done. And I had absolutely no conception that within a few years it would actually be my full-time occupation. It's still bizarre for me to think about that. But at any rate, here I am. And now I'm very much part of this online citizen journalism alternative media movement, whatever it is. I'm very much in the thick of it. And so people who are interested in finding out more, certainly they can look at CorbettReport.com. That's C-O-R-B-E-T-T report.com. And all of my various works on various websites is linked up there. And of course, people can also find my Gladio B series there on CorbettReport.com. So it's kind of the one-stop shop for everything you never wanted to know about James Corbett.
All right. Well, James, thank you so much for joining us on the show. As I said, we'd love to have you back on again sometime soon.
Well, thank you, Pierce. I enjoyed the conversation, and I'd be happy to do it whenever you need me.
All right. Awesome. Okay, everybody. So that was our conversation with James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, then please go to PorkinsPolicyReview.wordpress.com. And there you'll find this podcast and all the other podcasts that I've done, as well as writing and all sorts of things like that. And you can always subscribe through the RSS feed or through email. And you can always find me on Twitter at Porkins Policy. Well, I'll be talking to you very soon, and thanks for listening.